Well, hello, this is Pat Lynch, and you are listening and watching the Career Pathways Podcast, brought to you live from Kilt Studio, deep in the basement of the Mabee Simpson Library at Lyon College. Joining me behind the board, making the magic happen yet again, is...
Producer Jason.
All right, and joining us today as a special guest is one of our new faculty members, Brandon Porter. How are you, sir?
I'm well. How about yourself?
All right, and I got to get it out one last time that we'll got to say, let's go, Brandon, and now it's out of my system, completely yeah. Purged.
Yeah, that's been a common theme lately.
Yeah, and I know internally you're saying... Externally, you're saying thanks. Internally, I don't want to, you know, that's probably
I don't think it's fit
X-rated.
Yeah.
Well, welcome. Yeah. So how's your transition been to joining us as faculty?
It has been good. It has been a transition. It's amazing, you know, because I'm fresh out of grad school, but I do have some teaching experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like as a grad student, they let you teach like one course.
Right.
So it's definitely been... It's been a learning curve figuring out, you know, like what's possible versus what you want to do,
right?
Which has been fun. But you know, like the student body's great.
Yeah.
You know, getting to teach my social psych course, which is my discipline. But that's always a fun course to teach.
So what classes do you have this semester?
So I am teaching statistics.
Okay.
For the behavioral sciences. Then I teach social psych, and then two sections of intro.
Intro to psych. Okay. So did you have for intro, for all the classes, did you have to build up your curriculum over the summer, or did you inherit like a course plan?
So for the social class, you know, like that's a class I have taught before.
Okay.
So, I had everything ready to roll, mm-hmm. and then that was a nice smooth transition. Stats was the newest one.
So
that was the one where they've been sort of like building from the ground up and, you know, like. Even that, we're taking some adjustments because, you know, students come in with differing abilities, different levels of confidence when it comes to math or, you know, statistics itself is almost more of a logic based. But still, you have to learn, you know, like the basics of the software involved in order to do that stuff practically. Right. So that's sort of where the challenge is now is figuring out, well, what is the most viable path for that class? And then, of course, intro is a class. I taught it a long time ago.
Right.
That was my first class when I was, you know, just starting to teach as a grad student. So, like, that I'm treating that more or less as a new prep. Because it's, you know, of course, you know, Britt taught, is teaching it now. You know, Rob has taught. So, like, you know, they've all been very helpful. So.
Okay, as far as giving you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that... You know, one thing, you know, that's been a common theme with several of the faculty we've talked to and is everything around math and science anxiety that, you know, our students, you know, they come in and, you know, the stats class, that's for like psych majors, but...
psych majors, but I think there are also a bunch of exercise science.
And so... All of a sudden, you know, they have that, you know, statistics and they're in a cold sweat. I mean, how do you address that? How do you get them through that?
A lot of it is just easing into it and notice, you know, like this isn't just like abstract math on a, you know, on a chalkboard. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's problem focused. You know, you've got, whether it be an experimental design or you've got like a particular set of answers where you're trying to see, you know, what correlates. Did your experiment pan out?
Right.
So framing it very much, you know, within that broader research design, I think helps make it a little less scary. Makes it a little less math and a little bit more part of the process.
And I can identify. I know in business school, you know, I was a marketing major, but we needed quantitative methods and business analytics, which was statistics. And all of us as marketing majors just kind of took a blood oath and we took it in the summer, you know, when we could do nothing but that. And so then it was just, okay, I'm going to live and breathe it for 8 weeks and then I'll get through it. And that was all based on that anxiety. Now I got into the business world and all of a sudden actually application was all around me, and it wasn't too terrifying.
Yeah, that was the same with my experience. Undergrad experience, I took college algebra, and that was like my least favorite class ever. Then I took a stats class through the math department, and all I remember was the instructor like would point with his middle finger, and he would basically flip us off the whole time. I don't remember any concepts. But then I took, you know, by then I finally decided like, oh, I like psych. I'll be a psych major. So then I took psych through the stats department, and it was a totally different animal.
Okay, now you're a psychologist, and your professor's pointing every day with his middle finger. How do you interpret that?
I don't know. It just like there would be people laughing, and you know, it was just. But needless to say, like I don't recall a whole lot from it. You know, like and looking back now that I've got that basic framework, mm-hmm. I'm sure like that class would be much more approachable. But back then, it wasn't. At least for me.
Kind of going back to the beginning. Where are you from originally?
So I am from Central Ohio originally.
Okay, name it.
Yep, just north of Columbus. Small town called Johnstown.
Okay, I spent 2 years in Columbus, but Johnstown.
Yeah, it's like be 10 minutes like northeast of New Albany.
Okay.
That's sort of an up-and-coming
place. Which New Albany now is like, God, what?
Yeah, it used to be nothing but cornfields, and now it's...
The Limited went out there or something.
Yeah, Bob Evans moved their location. A ton of data servers for Facebook. Actually, ironically, that was my parents' old house. They were bought out, and now it's, you know, like data servers.
Yeah.
So they,
It's
very different.
So then you went to, I guess, high school in mm-hmm. Ohio?
Yep. Johnstown Monroe was the district.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And undergrad was where?
So undergrad, so when I was in high school, I started taking post-secondary credits. So I would hop in my car and I would drive to Columbus State Community College.
Yeah.
That's where I took my first psych class. That's where I started to realize I could do math maybe, you know, like didn't really like it, but it was okay. And then once I graduated, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but you know, mom and dad were insistent, like going to college.
Right.
So I went to Ohio State University, Newark campus.
Okay.
Because it was, you know, like I did not want to deal with the Columbus traffic.
Yeah.
The giant courses. So like the Newark campus was this really awesome place. They had a fully developed psych, you know, like they had several psych faculty folk mm-hmm. all doing research. They had a lab in the basement of one of the buildings. And it was there that early on, I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, like I think I was pre-med or pre-law or, you know, whatever it is, most people come in, you know. And then I thought like, man, I like political science. I took an anthropology course. Mm-hmm. And eventually I kind of stumbled on psych just as being, you know, the study of thought and behavior. And mm-hmm. I'm like, well, this is pretty neat. I could see myself doing that. And then I was asked by who had gone to become my thesis advisor, mm-hmm. Dr. Hupp, asked if I wanted to work in a lab. Yeah. I said, sure. And that's sort of how it got to start.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not what I do now. Right. You know, I was working in, it was a language development lab.
So mm-hmm.
they would do studies on children, studies on adults, and sort of try to determine the way in which we as human beings develop and use language.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I got my start.
And then graduate school, where
did you end up? So from there, at the time, I thought I wanted to do industrial organization psychology.
All right.
Because, you know, like I thought like that's where the money was.
Yes.
That's the practical thing to do. So like I applied to mostly IO programs. Mm-hmm. And then I did apply to one general psych master's program at University of Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, that's where I ended up going, where I worked under a social psychologist, R. Matthew Montoya.
Mm-hmm.
And there's where I finally sort of started to hone in my focus on, like, I'm interested in how people function in groups, how groups interact, and then sort of gradually did
that. Still sounds like you were in the industrial psych, you know.
Kind of, in a way. Yeah, that's the cool thing is, you know, like, I was able to stick with that you know, how people behave in groups, but I was able to take a much broader theoretical approach instead of, you know, like exclusively focused on business.
And then for your PhD?
Yeah, then I went to the University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
All right.
I was there for 6 years. I worked under Lowell Gertner.
Mm-hmm.
I had a blast.
Yeah.
You know, like we were interested in why people do extreme things. You know, like if you ask people if they'd be willing to say, have you ever heard of the trolley dilemma?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's like there's five people tied to a bridge, mm-hmm. pull a lever, and the trolley switches tracks and it kills one person yeah. instead of five. Do you flip the switch? Several social psychologists had been doing self-sacrificial variants of that, mm-hmm. where instead of you flipping the switch and it kills someone else, imagine flipping the switch and it kills you.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to do that for, say, five fellow Americans?
Right.
And a lot of people say they would.
Right.
Right. And Lowell and I were really interested in, like, but would they really?
Yeah.
In particular, there's a construct called identity fusion.
Right.
So when we think about ourselves, we can think about ourselves different ways, right? We can think about ourselves as unique people, right? Mm-hmm. Like unique person with these values, these traits, right. these beliefs. We can think of ourselves as big group members, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm an Arkansan now, right? Or, you know, member of Lyon College. So on these kind of broad categories. The idea is we can become so connected to that bigger collective that they can almost fuse. Mm-hmm. And when they're in that state, theoretically, people are willing to do really extreme things for the group.
That group think and everything.
Yeah, in a way. They're also willing to sacrifice the group for them, which is kind of this curious, distinct path.
Tell me more about that. Yeah.
So this would have been Lowell and a former student, but they found this really cool effect where traditionally you give people a scale with mm-hmm. these seven items. It's like the fight and die for the United States scale. Like I would be willing to, you know, to fight if someone threatened my country or if someone mm-hmm. threatened another member of my country. Flip it on its head, you'd be willing to let your group fight for you if somebody threatened you. Mm-hmm. And you find folks who are fused are also willing to do that. So there's a reciprocal action here, mm-hmm. Which is pretty neat. But we were really interested in how much of this is the manifestation of self-report. You know, like it's all, what would you do in this situation? Right. It's all like presented on a piece of paper as a 7-point scale.
Sure.
So we created scenarios in the lab, which as far as the participant thought, were actual opportunities to do something potentially painful. We created a bogus plasma drive.
Yeah.
We told them that the United States Blood Bank, an organization as far as we know didn't exist, is donating or is doing a donation, for, you know, a drive for donating plasma. They really mm-hmm. need it. The United States is facing a shortage.
Yeah.
If you want, you could fill out your survey for this study while donating plasma. It's kind of painful. Would you like to do that? And then just see if they say yes or no.
Right.
And then, of course, we give you know have a control condition where they just receive it in survey form. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're approached. And we did this across a variation of studies. We did one where it was they were asked to donate a small amount of skin to help mm-hmm. the United States Institute for Cancer Research.
Right.
We did a variation where the Department of Defense was doing a hybrid military program. And we started to see this cool pattern emerge where people who are fused do seem to be more willing to do potentially painful things, but only in a military context. So if you ask them to donate plasma, fusion does not predict.
Right.
When you ask them to donate a small skin sample, fusion does not predict.
Right.
Ask them to join the military, suddenly we see fusion emerging as a predictor, regardless of whether it's real or imagined.
Is it that sense of like a country or something greater than me that,
that
gets them
seems to be
past that?
That's sort of what we're exploring right now is it seems to be something about the nature of the threat, right? Like mm-hmm. one threatens group members, right. the other threatens the group's existence, the group
right.
as a whole, or the group's ideological component. So we designed a study where we went back to surveys and we just asked them, imagine something's about to happen that is going to harm and kill a lot of people, but not in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going to end the United States, but not harm a lot of people. And then we did a full factorial cross of group threat mm-hmm. versus member threat. And sure enough, we find fusion kicks in as a predictor only when the group's existence, only when that ideological component is sort of being threatened.
Well, it's inevitable. We got to jump to politics because because that's always that they're out to, you know, they're out to destroy us, you know, and create that sense of threat, and the sense of threat then brings cohesion, and then that cohesion gets people to go along with whatever the, you know, the platform is that you want to advance.
Yeah, and that's precisely sort of, it fits well with what we're seeing culturally, as well as it seems to fit the pattern of data that we're finding in the lab, as well as like decades of work in intergroup relations. Like, you know, like if you want to promote outgroup hostility, you know, create an existential threat, claim that the other group is a source of that potential threat, and as well as, you know, classic, you know, dehumanize them, you know, a whole host of really ugly things.
Yeah, kind of like my way of looking at the Ohio State Buckeyes. So that's
and that's as
it
a
works
Tennessee
for me.
As a Tennessee Vol for very briefly, you know, not briefly, I was there for 6 years, you know, like it was volunteer or nothing. And
right, then,
you
right.
know, back before that it was Buckeyes or nothing, and now it's I guess I'm a Scot now.
Yep, you're fighting Scot.
Yeah, I've got to merge.
You know that, you know, when you're talking about like groupthink, that the interesting thing is people say one thing, but what do they really do? And is that one of the bigger challenges in a lot of social psychology is how to really, you know, get past kind of the, because we're in a survey, we're all going to be our ideal self.
Yeah.
And we know that's not human nature. So what other kind of ways can you really find out how people will act?
Yeah. So that was actually one of the, certainly not a novel finding.
Yeah.
But it was one of the coolest things about the study designs that we'd ran
mm-hmm.
was when you ask people if they'd be willing to donate plasma in a survey.
Yeah.
You get like, I think it was close to about 40% would say, yeah, of course I would do that.
Yeah.
When you jump them in the real situation, it drops down to like, I think right around 18%.
Yeah.
So a substantial drop in the willingness. Same with the military. You know, like there we see like 20% are willing to claim they would do it, but then it drops down to about 5% when it's the real deal. So like that's always a concern. You know, one way that you can try to control for that is just, you know, always stick to your basic experimental design, you know, mm-hmm. like make sure you've got a comparable control group, you know, because mm-hmm. if you're looking at moderating factors, you know, like if I think a certain ideological component is going to lead to higher willingness, you know, mm-hmm. I should still see that across my conditions.
Right.
I'm just overall going to see a spike in willingness.
Yeah.
So like if I'm interested in base rates, I should be really concerned. But mm-hmm. if I'm just looking for like differences in you know, different moderating variables,
right.
you can still see that through the exaggerations.
Okay. With, as far as for group motivation and trying to, as a group leader, trying to kind of move them towards a shared sense of purpose and for a particular point of action, what other things could or can a leader do besides, you know, just pose that, you know, there's an existential threat to us? Because I don't know, that playbook won't work all the time.
Yeah.
So you need other things to kind of motivate.
Yeah, so social psych has studied that for a while too.
Yeah.
One area that sometimes works pretty well is, you know, like de-individuate. If you want, particularly if the goal is to promote,
mm-hmm.
you know, harmonious relationships between different groups,
right?
You know, like treat the other person as a person as opposed to a generic category member. If you're trying to get a particular group to work well alongside another group, you know, another strategy that works sometimes is like what we call a superordinate goal,
right?
And you know, Sharif way back in the 60s studied this with his, you know, with the infamous Robbers Cove study, mm-hmm. you know, where basically, you put kids into groups and make them compete, and sure enough, the groups come to hate each other.
Yeah.
Give them a big goal that they have to work together to sort of solve.
Yeah.
And they start to get along again. And, you know, so that is one option is to, you know, create a common goal that folks can work to.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, like works since like Alport has even it predates him, I think, contact, you know, like put people in contact with one another
mm-hmm.
As people, you know, right. and put it, make it good contact.
Yeah.
You know, give them something to do, give them something to work together with, and you can create more harmonious intergroup relations.
Yeah.
So a lot of it has to do with, you know, the specific goal that a leader wants. You know, like if it's to try to create harmony between groups, which would be a really good thing, you know, like there are certain approaches that could be taken that there's a lot of data to back up.
Yeah, because I, you know, in my, I put in a, you know, decades in corporate America. So, you know, I've had my trust falls and my scavenger hunts and my, you know, what one interesting thing about me and all, you know, all I could, the list can go on. And, you know, as far as to try and bring, you know, bring people together. I mean, kind of what does, in your opinion, what really does work or that's genuine and can hold?
I'd say the biggest one is stop treating people as category members and recognize them as, you know, unique individuals and create that connection at the individual level.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, there's a whole host of different theories that are going to argue different things. But, you know, I'd say that there's a fair bit of data to suggest that, you know. And, of course, my own work is more interested in that extreme behavior. So.
Yeah. When it comes to groupthink, how does it or has it changed by generations? I mean, you know, being that I'll be in the representative boomer in this room. So, you know, I mean, do boomers operate differently than Gen Z? Or is it really studied, or is it just doesn't matter?
I mean, in terms of like the tendency to form and maintain group memberships and act in a group serving way, I suspect, I'm not sure if I've seen any work that looks at it generationally. For the most part, you know, like we have a fundamental need to belong.
Yes.
And that's a really strong motivator to like help us form groups.
Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of that classic intergroup relations work, you know, like you can still see some variations of like the old Klein Klandinsky paradigm where you just tell people you prefer this painting, you prefer that painting, you're a group now. And then sure enough, you see them acting in group ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like that stuff works, you know, for the most part, you know, we're still human beings. Now, one area where you'll see the shifts, you know, that surface level stuff, you know, mm-hmm. like the types of groups folks join.
Right.
I was reading, it was like an op-ed, I can't remember where, but it was discussing just this, as you know, the types of groups we find ourselves more likely to join now mm-hmm. are different. You know, like a lot more people seek that social component, you know, on the internet than they would have, you know, decades ago. Or they seek it at a much broader, bigger scale, as opposed to like, you know, you don't often hear about kids like, I don't know, like going to a Rotary Club breakfast or something, you know, and that certainly can have an impact.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, those big, broad categories, it's certainly you're not going to get the same level, the same depth of connection that you might at a much smaller, localized group. And also the context is going to change.
Right, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, that's the one reality is so many people are retreating to their digital space. And so there's a lot more isolation, you know, that you see. And even it promoted with, you know, virtual work, you know, so work becomes a whole lot more distributed. And then, you know, you're trying to build a group and build cohesion and it's all just, you know, tiles on a Zoom call, you know, it probably represents a whole new challenge.
Yeah, for sure. You know, certainly the way the sort of like dominant modes with which we go about forming our groups, well, that stuff hasn't necessarily changed. It's all that context level, you know, it's like when we go to join something, you know, like, well, even like just, if we go to sign up for a basic service,
mm-hmm.
you know, like if I'm going to sign up for internet, I'm not going to go, you know, drive to the Optimum building to
right.
like, you know, sign up for internet. I'm going to do it online.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, certainly like the amount of in-person interactions we're probably seeing a decrease,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, whether or not we can make up meaningful contributions on an online,
mm-hmm.
I know there's some data to suggest like online connections can be real and they
right.
can be meaningful. It's a little outside my area though.
But. Oh yeah. Well, that'll be the relationship we have with our AI chatbot someday. You know, You got a name for your AI chatbot yet?
No, Jason? But I do have a friend that I've never met that I consider my best friend, though.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, those kinds of connections
I've known
can
for
be meaningful.
9 years.
What?
I mean, to be fair, I'm sure there's something psychological with that where I met him when I was, like, 13, you know, which is, like, the prime of, like, you know, making new experiences in life. But, like, 9 years. I mean, we've met once. He lives in Florida. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I live Minnesota, Florida. We never met for like 7 or 8 years, but we were best friends.
But you verified that this is like a real person. Not,
yeah, he's a year older than me.
But it's not Vladimir, you know, like living in a basement somewhere in Russia or anything like that.
And his girlfriend. I'm not gonna get too much into it, but his girlfriend like.
Oh, please do.
His girlfriend like lived in Illinois.
Okay.
And so, like, she had a lot of the Midwest commonalities that I did. So, like, he was like, she used to work at this place called Menards. And I was
I was like,
I know Menards. He's like, what? He's like, dude, this place is, like, so niche. I was like, no, dude, it's everywhere. Up there. Like, that is
that's
our
Home Depot.
Yeah,
of
that's
Midwest.
Our Home Depot. So, but yeah, like, we, you know, fun stuff like that. But yeah, we met online, like, video games, and then it's just moved from that. Like, we've.
All right. Yeah.
Servers, you know, games, you know. Like I still talk to him. Like he just sent me something like an hour ago.
Whoa! Dramatic change of subject. I'm going to have to come back to that sometime, Jay. Yeah, maybe when we start our podcast.
Okay.
You know,
we can do that.
Can we dial in it? Would your friend join us sometime?
I don't know. He's not that type of guy, but maybe. All right. If I asked him to, if I said like, "Hey, we talked about you on this podcast that I do," he'd probably be like, "Oh." But I mean, maybe he might join. Like,
awesome. Yeah.
Talk about relationships. But.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to dramatic change of subject. What do you have any research that you're working on right now?
Yeah. So we've got a couple things, you know, things that I want to get started as soon as I can. And then, of course, things that are currently underway.
Okay.
So one is the data that my collaborator / research mentor, Lowell Gertner, he's collecting at University of Tennessee. And there, we've designed this really cool study where we're presenting participants with what they think is a real situation. But we're varying whether or not it threatens the group or whether or not it threatens group members.
Right.
To see whether or not we can sort of tease apart that group threat versus member threat in what participants believe is an ostensibly real situation.
Right.
And then... I've got some, you know, we've got some work that one thing is I'd like to get started on a meta-analysis of the fusion and self-sacrifice data coming from existing other work. Right. So one really cool thing is when you look at the way these things are measured, you've got the fusion scale and you've got the fighting and dying scale. Two 7-item little scales, you know, again, assessing hypothetical behavior.
Right.
But when you look at the items of that fighting and dying scale, two of the items are actually more relevant to individual group membership well-being. So it's like, I would be willing to fight if someone threatened the life of another group member.
Right.
And when you split those two items apart from the rest and basically create two subscales of willingness to fight for the group, willingness to fight for members, fusion differentially predicts. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to basically reach out to anybody who's used these scales, get the data, and try to do a meta-analysis of it.
Nice.
Which that's sort of like, I view that as kind of low-hanging fruit that I'd like to do. And then, of course, we've got some data from like previous studies that I'd like to try to replicate. Had to move online just because, you know, these sorts of data collection, you know, they take sometimes 300, 400 participants. So it's, not always feasible to do in person, but online, I think we've got a couple studies where we'd like to do a variation of that trolley dilemma we talked about earlier, threatening fellow group members, in this case Americans, but varying whether or not those Americans are being individuated, right?
Okay.
Are they being named?
Yeah.
Is it Bill, Tom, George,
or
is it just Americans? The idea that maybe there's something about the when you hear the word fellow Americans activates almost, you know, this group consideration versus Hearing people being individuated right. really highlights their individuality. So maybe fusion will differentially predict there.
Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, those are, we've got a couple things sort of in the works.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as some sort of ideas that go further out.
Nice, yeah. And what about you're just kind of getting everything situated here at Lion, but do you have any courses that you'd like to introduce or create?
Yes. So one thing I have been working on is like what I would want to teach is like the ideal special topics for me.
Yeah.
And I think like what I really would like is a course on radicalism and extremism. You know, like how do people go about finding themselves in those, you know, extreme mm-hmm. groups?
Yeah, when they get what are some of those radicalized yeah, by exactly. watching YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, like there've been a lot, because a lot of work has been fixated on this really since 9/11, but it's right. sort of it's in a resurgence now because mm-hmm. you know, we're seeing it to such extreme degrees. But you know, there are really great books, you know, edited books coming out on extremism, exclusion, radicalization, and I think those would make really great sort of starting points for really a really awesome seminar course.
Yeah, because I read like that. That it's like the young male, isolated, lonely, that, you know, that all of a yeah. sudden now is one of those prime targets for, you know, some level of radicalization.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are different processes that, you know, so you've got some folks coming out of the ostracism literature who are saying, you know, like it's that exclusion. It's, mm-hmm. you know, these were groups that for years were, you know, like the, you know, top of the social hierarchy and, they still are,
yeah.
but the relative perception, you know, it's right. like they're losing ground and that creates that sense of exclusion.
Sure.
Then you've got the more group dynamic, you know, like they're perceiving their identity as under threat, you know, mm. and that creates that sort of highlights that identity yeah. is under threat and we need to, you know, do extreme action. But there's, yeah, it's currently being explored by a bunch of different avenues, mm-hmm. which I think would be oh, really be awesome to be able to explore yeah. that. From, you know, the different sets of literature to sort of, you know, dive into the social psych of it.
Any other courses in mind?
I mean, the classic is research method. You know, like, yeah. I think that's what I'm likely going to be teaching in the spring. And mm-hmm. that is a, like, if you can understand research method, you can understand, you yeah. know, most things, you know, like it's the most important course that they'll take in psych, particularly mm-hmm. if they want to go on to, you know, yeah. in academia. It serves as sort of the bare bones. But even if they don't want to go into academia, you know, being able to read scientific information mm-hmm. and read it critically is
right.
you know, critically important right now.
There you go. This is a podcast about careers. And, you know, so now you have, you're not advising yet, but you're going to, next academic year, you'll have psychology majors.
Yeah.
And, they're going to, you know, part of it's what course I need to take. Part of it is going to be kind of what kind of careers can I make out of being a psychology major? What advice would you have?
So, you know, one thing to keep in mind is like psych is a popular major. You know, if you look across a lot of universities.
Fourth most popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. you look at other universities, that's like, it's the biggest, you know, and like, there's a lot you can do with psych. Having an understanding of human behavior and thought and being able to apply that scientific mindset to mm-hmm. it can be invaluable across a lot of careers. You yeah. know, there's a lot of useful stuff in psych available to folks who go on to pursue HR. Mm-hmm. You know, marketing has a lot of you yeah. know, psychological principles. Economics, a lot of folks who, you know, pursue, get their PhD in psych, they end up in economics departments, you know, making a lot more money than we do in the psych departments. And of course, you know, there's always the classic, you know, like scientific avenue, which mm-hmm. is that's the area that I'm partial to, you
sure.
know, being in it. But even outside of it, you know, like there are now applied programs for industrial organizational where mm-hmm. folks can, you know, go in and get their master's in it and make really awesome careers.
Right.
Of, you know, working as consultants,
yeah,
helping businesses. Of course, you know, there's the counseling avenue for mm-hmm. folks who are more interested in helping, you know, individuals as opposed right. to businesses. But, you know, like now you've got like masters in social work. A lot of psych majors end up, you know, pursuing social work
right.
as their career of choice. And they go on to get masters in that, or they just go straight into the field depending on licensure stuff.
Sure.
But like it's a really nice major in mm-hmm. that, you know, you've got a lot of potential.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes it does take it's a bit of a longer path if you want that really specialized thing.
Yeah. And, but, you know, it's not that it's only leads to these two
yep,
types
exactly.
of careers, you know, and then it, in careers, you know, everybody thinks of them as just a linear line, you
yep.
know, that from start to always going up to the right. And it's actually just like, well, it's kind of like, Bethany and I, when we got into that raft for the, you know, and it kind of goes jig-jag and backwards
yeah.
and
yep.
circles and, you know, and it's, and so that's one that, you know, that's just more what the
yep.
career path is, and psychology just kind of gives you that bait, that foundation.
Yep. Yeah. And yeah. even within the major, you know,
yeah.
like within the psych major, you know, you can take courses that are more going to be more relevant clinical. You can take courses that are relevant, more for the counseling slash, you know,
mm-hmm.
social work avenue, the developmental avenue, there's the social side.
Yeah.
You know, there's the, there's just a lot, you know, and it's a really, it's a cool field in that.
Nice. Well, and just advance notice, I'll be, hitting you up next semester. Cause in the spring semester, I always teach consumer behavior. And so
I remember you telling me about that.
I always like to, you know, bring in, our social psychologist
yeah.
to kind of, talk with the class. It's, and they really like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, yeah. Persuasion, you know, the art
yes.
of persuasion is Cialdini's book.
Oh yeah.
It's like, it's a big area in psych, and it's a cool area, and it has an immediate application, which is, you know,
yeah,
it's always nice to when you can see that application, it makes it meaningful in the eyes of the students.
Yeah.
You know, and that always helps.
Well, perfect. Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up. You know,
yeah.
it's you with us, Jason, or you're not texting your friend, I hope.
No, okay. No, not yet. I will. Trust me, it will happen. But if he would be willing to get on a show, we could definitely get him on a show.
Oh, don't put any pressure, right? But yeah, it could be cool. But well, this is going to wrap us up. But before I start wrapping it up, I always turn it over to you. Okay, what question, Jason? If you have ESPN and you can read my mind. That's a dad joke, and you don't. It fell flat, and it
yeah.
should. But what question am I about to ask you?
Where can you find the Career Pathways podcast?
Oh my goodness! And the answer is,
you should say it since I said my. Since we reverse the roles, you know, reverse the roles here.
Okay, touche. All right, there you have a little throw.
Where
a little
can
French
you find the Career Pathways podcast?
Well, you can find it on every conceivable streaming platform. We've done the work, we've done the research, and what we have found is that you can find it at 99.7% of all possible things out there on the internet. So basically, you look, you will find the Career Pathways podcast, and you can listen to it in your automobile, you can watch us on YouTube. Well, we're everywhere. Did I do it justice, Jason?
Yeah, you forgot the germ part, but yeah. Well,
that's why I shouldn't be handling this. This is why you need to continue doing it,
because
you see what happens when you give it to an amateur. You know, I fail miserably.
Yep.
But Brandon, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Fun.
Yeah, you know, this is. But we've rolled through most of our new faculty, and we have. Brown Jane's coming up, and you know we threw a let's go Brandon. We're going to have to do the hardest working man in show business. Soul Brother number one. Brown James. You know that. Just got to do what you got to do. But welcome to Lion.
Yeah,
you
know, thanks.
We're very happy to have you. And
excited to be here.
Thanks, and. Thank you to our listeners and watchers of the Career Pathways podcast. come join us. You know, we podcast every other week, and you, what we have are interviews just like this. A great way to meet and learn more about our exciting new faculty that we have on campus. So again, we greatly, greatly appreciate that you're listening and watching. We hope you like us, put a recommendation out there, and we'll catch up with you next time. Take care. Bye.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Lyon College and by Kilt Studios.